So, I had a commander who is now a four-star general who, when I met him, before I'd given him any advice, gotten to know him at all, he said, "I'm really glad you're here. You know what the problem with our country is? We have too many lawyers and not enough farmers." He smiled at me and walked away. And I wanted to say, I think the problem, sir, is that we don't have enough people who take responsibility and rely too heavily on lawyers, or rely on them in the wrong way. I think what we have in the military is a recognition that when we place our legal advisors in the right part of the chain of command and we utilize them at the right time, that we add incredible value.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 3rd, 2014. That is the voice of Commander Michael Adams, Deputy Legal Advisor to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Operational Lawyer for Special Forces, and the author of a new paper, not yet published, on what he calls jus extra bellum, the state's right to conduct national security activities outside of warfare. Commander Adams presented on the subject in Manila this week at the MILOPS conference, and we sat down afterwards to discuss this provocative subject. We talked about the post-AUMF world, and we talked also about advising special forces and the role of the operational lawyer. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 73, Commander Michael Adams talks jus extra bellum.
What is jus extra bellum?
It's the idea of the state's right outside of war. You know, we normally talk in terms of jus ad bellum, state's right to war. We talk about jus in bello, the state's right in war. But we don't really have a good legal framework that articulates sort of the parameters of national security activities that might be conducted as a matter of state's right. The sovereign right of states manifested in a historic pattern of state conduct based on a sense of international legal freedom and pursuant to domestic law and obligations, particularly as we look post-major combat operations in Afghanistan, potential refinement or repeal of the 2001 authorization for the use of military force. Jus extra bellum, to a certain degree, allows us to look at what else we might be doing in the national security arena.
Bring it out of the level of abstraction. What is the concept of, you know, what are the specific sets of activities that the concept of jus extra bellum includes?
Sure. And admittedly, there are a broad array, but some examples would be, obviously, diplomacy, and intelligence across borders and intelligence sharing. Influence operations that don't intrude on sovereignty, territory, or political independence as a matter of law, but inform and shape the perspectives of foreign populations. Another would be cyber defense or other cyber activities that don't rise to the level of the use of force. Criminal law enforcement with the consent of the host nation or with assistance of foreign partners. Another example would just be partner capacity building, advice and assistance at large, in particular in situations that support other states' internal aggressors and threats. You could go and apply jus extra bellum towards economic measures like sanctions and seizure of assets. I think a prominent one that the global community has expressed its support for in very formal manners previously would be counterproliferation and upstream defeat of weapons of mass destruction and more recent concerns about stopping the dispersal of improvised explosive devices and components. You could apply it to freedom of navigation and overflight assertions. You could apply jus extra bellum to any other number of national security actions undertaken pursuant to a UN Security Council resolution or other international legal authorizations. And I think one activity along those lines, as an example, would be counter-piracy operations, which we've seen big international consensus towards. And then perhaps even on the higher end, discrete lethal or capture-kill operations in common parlance now, when required as a matter of self-defense. And I realize that's a lot, but that's kind of the point, that states conduct most national security activities as a matter of sovereign right, and really always have.
You've teased this a little bit, but let's lay it out. Why is this an important subject?
Well, so I think there are a few reasons. I think, first off, it's important to recognize that the President of the United States has made clear his intentions to get the United States off of, quote, perpetual wartime footing. And so as we look at that, I think one piece of what we consider is what we're going to look like going forward. So if we draw down in Afghanistan, if we change the domestic legal authorities under which we operate, we still need to have a legitimate basis for the activities in which we engage. And so I guess the first piece would be it's a recognition of the president's commitment to change sort of the wartime paradigm that we've been in since 9/11. I think the second piece is we recognize that in the developing world that it's important for us to rely on some of our partner activities and to work with our allies, partners, and individuals and groups that are affected by the global threats that are out there. And so as we look at that, it would be exceedingly difficult for us to turn to someone or something and say, we need your help in this, but ignore our uncertain legal bases for these activities. What this allows us to do to a certain degree is to say to them, hey, here are our legal foundations rooted in historic state practice and now recognized by, you know, perhaps a novel framework, but something that states have been doing for a long period of time. So the president's commitment, the reliance on partners, and I think the other piece is just simply the threats that are out there require us to continue to engage in a wide range of national security activities.
So, but hang on. I hear the human rights voice saying you have a fancy Latin term that you're describing as a post-AUMF environment that sounds like you get to do all the same things that you can do under the AUMF. How is the framework that you're describing different from the framework that currently exists? Or is it just a fancy way of saying broad powers persist even after the AUMF disappears in a puff of smoke?
Well, clearly the first difference is there are much more robust authorities in war. The idea that you have a belligerent force that you can target and resort to lethal force as a first resort certainly applies at war. The ability to detain individuals until the end of the conflict is obviously a significant piece in war. You know, the outside of armed conflict, it gets trickier, right? You look at the imminence of the threat and need to be able to, at a minimum, articulate a justification for the activities in which you engage. And you go down the line of whether you actually have to get to the point of using force instead of instantly resorting to it as a first resort. The detention piece becomes much more challenging, where you look towards potentially a criminal law enforcement paradigm, which again has different rules for the use of force. So I think there's some pretty substantial differences.
So when you gave your talk yesterday, there was a question from the audience that was quite hostile to the premise here. And the premise of the question was, hey, wait a minute, there is an international law here. It's that there's war and that there's peace. There's, you know, wartime authorities, there's peacetime law enforcement authorities. You've made up a term that allows, or that if accepted, would allow you to use a whole lot of wartime authorities in place of peacetime authorities. In conditions of peace. In the paper, you describe that you haven't really made up anything except a name. In fact, these authorities are long-lived and they've kind of always been there. I'm interested for your reconciliation of it. Why shouldn't, a international law or human rights minded person say, wait a minute, this is a very clever device to import a lot of wartime authorities into peacetime?
So I think that I would flip that a little bit. I think that there's a clear historical record of activities conducted not just by the United States, but countries across the world to provide for their citizen security. We're sitting in the Pacific theater right now, where states rely heavily on things like maritime domain awareness, upon freedom of navigation and moving across the domain to recognize where threats might exist. There's intelligence collection that comes into that. There are military exercises that are a piece of that, and a whole host of other things. I mean, the audience yesterday, one of the big pieces that we focus on was humanitarian assistance and disaster response. You know, there's a different narrative depending on where you are in the world. So to some, the important piece is the right to engage in intelligence collection and understand the environment. To others, it might be to defend against terrorists or insurgent groups within their state or emanating from across their borders that present an immediate lethal threat to them. And so the right to defend citizens against a lethal threat is a piece of it. And there's a full range of activities there that we could probably discuss forever.
Tell us a little about your background.
Yeah, so you know, while I offer all of these comments in my personal capacity, I'm currently a deputy legal counsel to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And what that effectively means is that I am a legal advisor charged with advising on international, operational, national security law issues that affect the various combatant commands around the world. So whether that be a four-star commander responsible for what we call U.S. Africa Command or U.S. Central Command or U.S. Pacific Command, or whether it be a combatant command like U.S. Special Operations Command, I help advocate for the combatant command's interests at the joint staff level and also up to the Secretary of Defense for the Department of Defense. That's what I currently do. I was originally a line officer serving on two ships out of Pearl Harbor, but then I was selected for the Navy's Law Education Program and since have worked, did a little bit of time doing some criminal work and basic litigation. But I spent close to 5 years working in the special operations community, working combined joint operations, multiple deployments to Afghanistan, deployed to Iraq, deployed around the Pacific Rim, Horn of Africa, and some other areas.
So what I think of you, partly because of the circumstances in which I got to know you, I think of you as an operational law guy, that's kind of what you think about a lot. Talk about being in operational law and what it means to advise people who are doing special operations.
So, well, first thing I'd say is that's probably the best job a military attorney could ever have. You have the opportunity to work with our elite forces and to attempt to facilitate the necessary objectives that they're trying to accomplish. But it takes many forms. It's everything from training them on rules of engagement, human rights obligations, and any number of issues that they're challenged with, to developing scenarios and tactical environments in which they develop the instincts so that they understand the rules and can apply them real time. They're not feeling overly constrained or second guessing themselves. And the other piece of it is you have an opportunity to see and experience some pretty unique operations that you wouldn't see elsewhere. And I think that's something I've been very fortunate to be a part of.
Give us an example of a highly unusual situation in which you've had to make a legal judgment that a normal lawyer would not have to.
So one that is common to the special operations attorney that might seem completely foreign to most practitioners of law is sort of the idea of real-time targeting and operations. So I've had the good fortune to work on staffs where I sat side by side with the commander, the operations officer, the intelligence officer, and the senior enlisted advisor, and watched and listened to real-time feeds of operations that we had. We had planned, rehearsed, trained to, developed standards for, tailored rules of engagement to, and then sort of from a distance participated in real time, whereby there have been instances where the commander turned to me, and all of my colleagues have done this as well, and kind of looked at us for legal advice real time while operations were ongoing. Now, I don't mean in any way to suggest that advice was, hey, can we shoot here, or something that would be overly restrictive to the guys out on the X. But rather, you sort of learn through body language and over time the comfort level of the commander in the next iteration of the operation, and what's about to happen, and you can kind of gauge and advise real time on where things are going. Now, obviously, I can't get into too much in the details, but the idea that you can potentially have a positive effect and help to protect the guys that are out there doing their thing, and also ensure that the operation is conducted in a lawful and appropriate manner, it's pretty empowering. From an outsider's perspective, a lot of people think of especially the SOF, operational attorney, as sort of some sort of Warren Zevon song, you know, talking about lawyers, guns, and money. And I think in reality, our role is largely the same as any other judge advocate or military attorney. You know, to a large degree, we're generalists. We provide legal assistance to service members to make sure they don't have to worry about issues back at home when they're forward deployed. We review any number of investigations. You know, some of those are criminal in nature. Some of them deal with very significant strategic issues like civilian casualties. We advise on military justice, you know, a form of criminal law. And then we do have some specialized skills, whether it's SOF or operational law attorneys in general. I mean, certainly in the SOF community, it's important to understand, and frankly for a judge advocate to remind themselves, that they're not a shooter. They're not there to be an operator. You know, we might have some specialized training in shooting, communication, moving, maybe even jumping out of airplanes. But that training is largely designed to ensure that we're not a detriment to the mission or other personnel, essentially that we're not dead weight. Another specialized piece in operational law in particular is fiscal law. There's an old saying that says, operational law is fiscal law. And that seems counterintuitive to a lot of people, but the reality is, when you want to execute missions, you have operational lines of authorities, things that come in the form of exords and orders, execute orders and orders, rules of engagement, those kinds of pieces. And then you have fiscal law, which says you can use this money for this thing. Now, that doesn't sound as exciting, but if you don't have the money to conduct the activity, you don't conduct the activity. And then I think there, you know, understanding of other soft-specific authorities or authorities applicable to whatever types of operations you're going into. So a naval officer worth his salt obviously has to be familiar with the law of the sea and understand how to apply it. I do think that in the SOF community, you have individuals who have a deeper understanding generally of how to apply ROE to particular tactical situations. And then I think the foremost sort of requirement for those individuals is to be able to thrive in dynamic environments when life and death quite literally are an issue. And in those environments, to maintain perspective, ultimately add value and support the mission. The reality is you're often forward and alone from a legal perspective, and you have to find creative means to reach back and get the assistance you need. I've been very fortunate that the Navy JAG Corps has some mechanisms in place for that. And frankly, what I used more than anything was a group of guys and ladies we called the Tier 1 Bar Association, a small group of soft professional attorneys across the branch of services that I could reach out on a moment's notice and say, hey, we got a real tough problem here. Let's figure out how to work on it together.
People talk kind of blithely now about how lawyered military operations are. In your experience, is the role of lawyers about right? Is it too much? Is it too little? Is it largely a good thing? How should we understand the military being at the operational level, peopled by people like you?
So I had a commander who is now a four-star general who
when I met him, before I'd given him any advice, gotten to know him at all, he said, "I'm really glad you're here. You know what the problem with our country is? We have too many lawyers and not enough farmers." He smiled at me and walked away. And I wanted to say, "I think the problem, sir, is that we don't have enough people who take responsibility and rely too heavily on lawyers, or rely on them in the wrong way. I think what we have in the military is a recognition that when we place our legal advisors in the right part of the chain of command and we utilize them at the right time, that we add incredible value.
And what's the value that we add?
Well, I think the value is that we allow the commanders to make a more informed decision about the operations they conduct. I certainly am very familiar with some of your work in the detention field, and I know that there have been times in the past where had we had a more deliberate or thoughtful approach to certain parts of our detainee activities, we might have had better long-term success. And I think that is an example where getting the lawyer on the front end makes a whole lot of sense. I think real-time operations can be a challenge. We train our service members on rules of engagement. We train them on their human rights obligations. We train them on any number of scenarios in which they might engage. And so what we try to do is we try to get them to the point of developing instincts that not only execute the mission in the way they want to execute it, but comply with the law and our obligations. But if you put a lawyer too far to the right in the execution timeline and you say, okay, let's call back to the lawyer every time we want to do something, that can be a problem. That can be a problem. And I don't mean to suggest that when we're doing, when we're engaging in certain kinetic activities where we have a more deliberate process and time to think through the pieces, that we absolutely shouldn't rely on the lawyer to help with that. But there's a real tough balance of where we should be inserted in the process and to what degree.
So how does this connect to the article? Does the role of lawyers become more or less important as you move away from an AUMF framework and toward a post-AUMF framework?
So I think more important. At the risk of sounding like I'm creating future responsibilities and jobs for myself, war is hell is a common refrain. Certainly war isn't easy, but in some respects, from a legal perspective, war is a lot easier than activities outside of armed conflict. You know, when you look at...
Break that down. Why?
Well, when you look at, you know, activities conducted in discrete geographic regions where we have a jus in bello that we can turn to. Now, certainly those aren't entirely prescriptive and detailed, but they give you a good framework that we've trained to for years and years and years, and we know how to execute. You know where you can operate, you know generally what your rules are, and you have some pretty robust authorities in which to operate. When you step outside of the geographic bounds of that conflict, or you step outside of it as a matter of, you know, the conflict's over, or we don't recognize it as a policy choice, then you have to say, okay, what rules do apply? Right? And how do we execute our activities going forward? So you mentioned the human rights law paradigm. So in war, you know, lethal force as a first resort is an option under international humanitarian law. You go to the human rights law paradigm, and it's more of a lethal force as a last resort. And I'm oversimplifying that, but that's the gist of it. And it's very similar to criminal law. And so you then enter into... what are the implications for it? So let's take cyberspace activities as an example. In war against an enemy, if you're engaged in certain activities, you might have some pretty robust authorities to go after the enemy. When you move outside of that conflict and you look at, you know, transnational cyberspace activities, and you consider
principles of sovereignty and non-intervention. You look at privacy interests, you know, particularly when we talk about our European partners under the European Convention of Human Rights or the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, both recognizing privacy to a certain degree. There are implications that are more complex that come into play and frankly require a little more detailed and deliberate legal planning than you might have in conflict itself.
So at what level are these questions decided? Are these questions that are decided at the macro policy level and general counsel level, or are these jus extra bellum questions decided at the operator level?
I think going forward, we anticipate that a lot of these are going to be decided at a very high level. We participate in an interagency lawyers group that is pretty open about discussing the most significant policies of the U.S. government and how those things are going to be shaped. Now, obviously, I can't go into the details on particular discussions, but what I recognize is that to a certain degree, there's a flatness amongst the high-level interagency where we have very frank discussions about what policies are being considered, what the legal implications of those policies are, and what our recommendations should be going forward. So you have kind of that level up at the highest level. You have that part of the discussion. But I also think there's a point of execution where those high-level decision makers and advisors normally don't have a whole lot of visibility. And so when you get outside of armed conflict and you look towards the types of activities in which we engage all across the world, once the policy's been set, once the orders have been given to go out and execute, there are day-to-day determinations that are made. There's advice that's given that has to be made in real time. And so our system, while it's not, you know, a specific structure that's been created for that purpose, I think it implicitly recognizes that there has to be greater speed, flexibility, and adaptability at the lower levels once those decisions have already been made. And that's where, frankly, a lot of the military legal advisors make their money, because they get put out in a forward location where they're faced with these great challenges and they have to take whatever guidance they have and work diligently to give the best advice they can. And frankly, sometimes policy guidance isn't all that clear.
So your article hasn't been published yet, but it has been pretty widely circulated. I mean, a lot of people around here have read it. I know you've gotten some feedback from the human rights community about it. I'm curious what the reception to it's been. You're still making changes to it, but have people responded to this as, you know, a kind of devious plot, or has it been more receptive than that?
It's definitely been more receptive than that. In all frankness, when I first articulated the concept, I expected to get laughed out of the room. I thought that I was advising some very senior officers on some cyberspace and information operations activities, and I really was struggling to figure out how to speak in the terms that they understood, because we talk so much about ad bellum and in bello and the rules in war and warfare, and that's sort of how some of our operators are trained. And so I really was trying to just give them something that they could work with. And I broke out the jus extra bellum construct because I thought it would be familiar. And it worked with them. It gave them something they could understand and sort of a canvas upon which we could build our discussion. And then I tried it again in an academic environment. And I got pretty good feedback. I mean, I normally get one of two responses. One is, we don't need this. We're fine with what we've been doing forever. You're talking about how we've been engaging in historic state practice. We're going to continue to engage in historic state practice. And I think that's a reasonable response. I think the second response has been, hey, this is interesting. This is interesting. I'd like to help you try to shape this, because I think there's some value in that.
But there's a third possible response, right, which is, this is a name for historic state practice. Right, there's You got your war power, you got your war, you got your peace, but you also have all this activity that people do, states do during periods of peace. Some of it looks a lot like war. And there's no real name for it. And you've kind of given it a name.
I've given it a name. But the challenge, Ben, if we just accept that, hey, we've always done this before, is that's not a particularly good legal framework upon which to build a constructive dialogue. We've always done this before is about the worst answer I've ever gotten from those clients that I've advised, right? I mean, the one thing, you know, when they send a proposal to you and you get it and you look at it and you say, well, this doesn't comply with the law. And they say, we've always done it this way. You know you got a problem. You know you have a problem. And I don't mean to say that anecdotal piece translates necessarily on the macro level, but it kind of does. And the reason I say that is, you know, in the human rights context, there's been a lot of criticism of the U.S. government's policy and our longstanding position of not applying human rights law extraterritorially. Again, that's a bit of a swag of the position, but that's the gist of it. So the human rights response I've gotten to this has been, hey, this is kind of interesting. But we don't think you're giving enough deference to human rights law. And so now that gives us an opportunity to say, okay, if we put this framework up there, if we talk jus extra bellum, what should human rights law look like? What should be the interplay if we go post-major combat operations and we start talking about partnered activities in an area outside of active hostilities? What should the human rights law paradigm be? And you could say the same thing for cyberspace. When the United States and China and Russia talk about cyber activities and our lexicon is so dramatically different, we're literally talking in a different language, right? Now, we have our own challenges in the U.S. government on getting our lexicon aligned, but at least this gives us an opportunity to say, hey, you know what? We're going to engage in some level of cyber activities. These are transnational activities that go across borders. And largely what we're doing is outside of armed conflict. What should our normative standards be like going forward? Right? I mean, one of the historic examples of this was piracy, where states faced a significant problem, and it was a common problem. And we didn't agree on all the principles and the terms, but we were able to go out and have a constructive dialogue and figure out certain pieces of that problem that we needed to be able to address collectively and create rules that allowed us to get after that. And you can see those to a certain degree articulated in the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music, as always, is performed by the Right Honorable Sophia Yan. We still need your help in spreading the word about the Lawfare podcast. Lots of people still don't know about it, so tweet it, share us on Facebook, do what you have to do to bring it to them. They'll thank you for it later, I promise. Thanks for listening.